Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the 8th lecture of the fall series of the Vancouver Institute. Those of you who come here regularly will not be surprised to know that my name is still John Madden and I'm still president of the Vancouver Institute. I'd just like to ask, how many of you are here for the first time this season? Oh, good. Okay, well, welcome. We're delighted to see you. You may have seen, as I saw one couple come by the desk on the way in and look to see if they had to pay. And of course, you don't have to pay. These are free public lectures. But you may want to know, it would certainly be appreciated. This is one of those old-fashioned kinds of organizations that operates by donations. Most of our expenses are by way of advertising for the lectures, and that's supported by people buying memberships, which are very inexpensive, $5 for a student, $15 single, $25 for a family. The main privilege is that of knowing that you've contributed to something worthwhile. Has this gone off? The main privilege is knowing that you've contributed to something worthwhile, but if you arrive before 8 o'clock, you do get to sit in the front rows. After 8 o'clock, front rows are opened up to everybody. The lecture this evening is the second in a series of three dealing with oceans. Some of you were here last week and would have heard a fascinating lecture concerning the 16th century Basque ship which was sunk in Red Bay, Labrador. This evening, of course, we're hearing Professor Walters. And next weekend, we will be listening to Professor Verena Tunnicliffe, who is an international expert on life in the hot vents under the sea. Her talk will be a deep sea fantasy world. Carl Walters is a professor in the Fisheries Center and Zoology Department here at UBC. He's been on the UBC faculty since 1969, doing research and teaching in fisheries population dynamics and applied ecology. His university degrees are in fisheries. He did a Master of Science and PhD degrees at Colorado State University on fish populations in high mountain lakes. Since coming to UBC, he's worked mainly on Pacific salmon and other marine fisheries, with emphasis on the development of methods for managing sustainability in the face of high uncertainty and limited information. He's authored over 100 scientific papers and 2 books on this subject. He's been active in public debates about management and conservation of Pacific salmon and has advocated major changes in management approaches to meet biological and institutional requirements for conservation. Besides fisheries research, he's been active in development of an interdisciplinary approach to dealing with natural resources and environmental management issues by using computer modeling and field experimentation to clarify and test policy options. This approach is now widely known as adaptive management. You will have understood that I was reading this little piece about Professor Walters. Some of you may also know that he recently produced a report for the David Suzuki Foundation entitled Fish on the Line. You should be aware, and it's certainly alluded to in the brief biography that I read, that he doesn't just study fish. He also studies bureaucracies, particularly the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. He had some fairly strong things to say about bureaucracies in the course of looking at the total system of fisheries. Professor Walters' talk this evening is entitled The Crisis in Canadian Fisheries. Please welcome Professor Carl Walters.
Can you hear me all the way up in the way, way in the back there? Because my voice is about 3/4 gone due to the cold that half of Vancouver has right now that settles somewhere between your stomach and your lungs. So I hope my voice will hold up for the time here. Okay, now what I'm going to do is to take you on a bit of a tour through from an academic's perspective of what's happening to our fisheries in Canada today, and try to draw some lessons from what's happening from an academic's perspective about what we, the people of Canada, probably are going to have to do if we want to maintain those precious resources. Fish touch all of us in Canada. I know there are very few Canadians who are not deeply interested in one way or another in fish, whether it's fish to eat or fish to catch for recreation or fish as an industry or fish as the basic support for key parts of our culture. And I don't think any Canadian was untouched 3 years ago with the closure of the East Coast cod fisheries and the enormous devastation, the social and economic devastation that that's caused for the people of Newfoundland and the Maritimes. I think a key principle I'll be following throughout the talk is we here, the notion that we're talking, when we talk about fisheries, about a public resource, a heritage, a value to all Canadians and to our children. And much of my work and my perspective is drawn from the notion that we deserve better. Now, a lot of what I'm going to say to you tonight is drawn from my attempts to understand this picture right here. This picture compares trends in harvest to the two most valuable fisheries in Canada. On the East Coast, we are looking at here about 100 years of history of the Newfoundland cod fishery, from 1880 until it was finally closed in 1992, a complete disaster. In stark contrast to that is the history of our salmon fisheries here on the Pacific coast, where not only have we sustained very high catches, but in the last 30 or 40 years, we've actually seen increasing abundance of some of our salmon stocks. We've seen healthier populations. And I think we've got to stop and ask how it could be that these two situations could diverge so dramatically. How could it be that in a system that has the same governance, that has the same governing bodies, the same laws, the same massive fisheries and oceans bureaucracy, we could end up with two such starkly different outcomes? And we've also got to ask whether the East Coast outcome is in our future here in British Columbia. Now, we can't explain this monstrous difference as being due to any of the simple things you read about in newspapers, like massive fishing technologies, the power of fishermen to destroy the resources. Our British Columbia salmon fishermen, since at least 1930, have had the technological capability to destroy our salmon resource here in BC in about a week or two of fishing, yet it hasn't happened. We certainly can't blame or explain this huge difference as being due to simple matters of salmon are visible and easy to count because they come into streams to spawn either. They come into streams to spawn after we do the damage to them, after we harvest them. So the best we can do with salmon that's different from the East Coast is to know a little sooner how bad a job we did. Being able to count salmon in spawning streams has not helped us to manage them at all. Now, I'm going to draw some key lessons from this difference as we go through the talk. I think it's fundamental to understand why there are a few situations like here in BC or Alaska that where we have managed to sustain fisheries in the face of all of the forces of destruction that you read about in newspapers. We also cannot explain the difference between BC and the East Coast just by the enormous biological diversity of our salmon populations. This is a map of BC. I'm sorry it's a bit difficult to see, but when you blow up any part of our province, like Vancouver Island here, what you see is an extraordinarily complex network of streams and waterways, most of which support salmon that are genetically adapted to the particular conditions they find in those streams. We guess that there are something in the order of 3,000 to 5,000 genetically distinct races of salmon in British Columbia. Now, you might argue that the big difference between us and Newfoundland is just that we have so many stocks of fish. Well, that's not true at all, because We don't manage all of those thousands of stalks separately. Instead, what we do is to harvest them in a few very large areas when they're mixed together off the west coast of Vancouver Island, or in the Georgia Strait, or up by the Queen Charlottes. And practically nothing that we do is aimed at trying to maintain that extraordinary diversity, and in fact, we're gradually eroding it away over time, managing a few populations well and most very poorly. If I had been able to draw a slide of it to show the situation here in BC, I think a far better slide and image to have provided you might have been one of you driving out to the Fraser Valley, and you see a beautiful new factory with two floors. And in front of this factory, or behind it, is a large number of trucks lined up with their engines roaring, horns honking. And it's clear that there's a great deal of industrial activity going on in that plant. So you stop to see what's there, and you see a beautiful big sign at the front saying, BC Toy Company, with the slogan underneath, Pursuit of Excellence. So you walk up to the door and assign direct inquiries upstairs. So you go to the first to the second floor of this factory. And instead of a factory, what you see is dozens and dozens of desks with administrators and accountants and managers sitting there at their computers exchanging email. And as you start to ask them what this factory is about, you go from desk to desk and all you can get is shrugs. No one seems to know what they're about. So you decide to explore a little further and you walk downstairs in this factory. And you find a factory floor with just a few dozen people, and it may be only a dozen, running around frantically with faulty equipment that's breaking down all the time, desperately trying to make the system work, hopelessly inadequate in terms of the task and the equipment that they have and the facilities that they have to produce much. But they are producing a few cartons of toys. And each time a carton of toys comes off their conveyor belt, they run with it out to the loading bay, where there's a mad scramble amongst the truckers there, and the box is grabbed by the nearest trucker, and he roars away. And there's a man standing on the loading dock with a clipboard in hand and a big smile on his face, and you think, well, maybe this person knows what's going on. And you say, who are you? He says, well, I'm the union shop steward. Aren't we doing a wonderful job at providing employment for truckers here in British Columbia? So you move on to the truckers and ask them what they think about this situation. They say, well, there's too many truckers out here, but this is a wonderful lifestyle. We're free and easy. We can travel as we wish. We have the freedom of the land, like fishermen have the freedom of the sea. And this is a wonderful situation for us. And it doesn't really provide a great deal of employment, but then Canada's social safety net takes care of that problem for us. So what we see is in British Columbia, hiding behind this magnificent diversity of fisheries opportunities that we have, we see a system that's pathologically unhealthy in terms of its social and economic structure. People who write about sustainability, a word that I've never really quite been able to understand, even though I'm supposed to be a scientist in that field, really talk about two things. They talk about ecological sustainability, the maintenance of biodiversity and the habitats for producing organisms that we enjoy, and the management and limitation of the harvest that we take. But they place equal weight, and rightly so, on economic management, on self-sufficiency, on community-based and localized management systems that can deal with the complexity of nature down at the scale where we see it developing, and on avoiding unnecessary waste. Well, maybe here in British Columbia we aren't doing too bad on the ecology side of sustainability. We certainly are not doing well on the economic side. And I'll come back to that. Now let me talk to you for a little while here about why it is that fisheries collapse. There have been enough of these horrible disasters around the world. The first really big one was the Peru Anchoveta fishery that collapsed in 1970 and 71, virtually destroyed the economy of the nation of Peru when it went. Every bit as bad a disaster as our Newfoundland cod collapse. And there's been enough of these things that we could actually develop a fairly elaborate taxonomy of them. which is not saying much for our ability to manage sustainably. But I think when we cut through the complexities of that taxonomy, there's really three things that go wrong in different circumstances. The first and one that's perhaps most obvious to people is failures in the governance system, failures of our administrative and bureaucratic systems to manage effectively even when information is available. And there's bad science as well, and I'm going to show you what to someone in my profession is the worst possible nightmare that could ever happen. I'll try to show you that the Newfoundland cod disaster was basically caused by my particular scientific specialty of stock assessment, the errors that we made. And then there are cases, the easiest cases really to deal with, that just involve bad luck. And let me talk about that a little bit because it has something to do with difficulties in developing good policies. There are enormous changes going on in the world around us. The marine climates that produce fish and the freshwater climates that produce them are undergoing violent changes, both natural and man-made. The effects of these huge changes on abundance of fish are confounded. That is, when we see a population of fish collapsing in nature, we very often can't tell, until it's well along at least, whether it was caused by something natural or something we did. And the effects of changes in environment and our impacts of fishing and other human activities are all compound one another. So scientists, it's become a major discipline in fish research in recent years to study what's called fisheries oceanography, to basically document the massive changes in the carrying capacity and capability of the ocean that's going on. This is a picture from a recent publication here on the West Coast showing that the capacity of the North Pacific Ocean to grow salmon has fluctuated through the century by a factor of almost 3, with huge ups and downs on decadal time scales. And when we see the downside of one of these massive fluctuations, we cannot, in principle, tell whether it's due to something wrong in the way we manage or to nature getting back at us. We've tried to deal with a lot of that natural variability with technological fixes. We've tried to use hatchery production systems to stabilize survival rates of fish in the ocean. It hasn't worked at all, as you can see from this graph. This is a picture for the Georgia Strait of our hatchery releases of small juvenile coho salmon that support one of our more valuable BC fisheries, recreational fishery for coho salmon. We have, over the last 25 years, built up the number of fish we release from hatcheries to be about equal to the wild production of coho salmon by all of the 100-odd streams that produce them around the Georgia Strait. Well, you can see how well we've done from that program up in the top graph. That's the catch of coho salmon. And isn't it obvious how, as we doubled the number of juvenile fish that we've sent out to sea, at enormous cost to the Canadian taxpayer, how much we've increased the coho catch out there. Well, environmental factors are often blamed by those who want to keep our hatcheries going for this catastrophic failure. And as scientists, we simply can't say it's wrong. We cannot reject the hypothesis that we've just been unlucky and that hatcheries, if we just keep them going for a year or two longer, will start working. And it's all a matter of us being patient with our hatchery administrative systems. So bad luck causes us big problems because it makes us unable to really say what's causing some of the changes we see out in nature. Bad governance could arise in principle from just plain incompetence, and I think we have examples in fisheries here in Canada of where people who are managing and administering our fisheries, largely people trained as biologists, just haven't got a clue how to step beyond the fish and understand fisheries as systems that involve both people and fish. They can't seem to do the obvious there. We also have things going wrong that you see every day in the newspapers involving the capture of our management agencies by industries. And that's promoted by how our fishing industries here in Canada, our fishing interests, are some of the most vociferous interest groups that any politician would ever have to face. And our interest groups are extraordinarily effective at disinformation campaigns, at the not me business. You can hardly pick up a newspaper with a quote from a Canadian fishing interest here in Vancouver, but where that fishing interest will blame someone besides himself. If you're a commercial fisherman, you blame habitat destruction, you blame sport fishermen, and you blame natives. Those are the three scapegoats for commercial problems these days. If you're a sport fisherman, you blame natives and habitat and commercial fishermen. It just goes on and on and on like that. Government administrators are barraged with this kind of disinformation, and it's presented in a every bit as complex and apparently sophisticated way as you see in this bizarre picture. What happens in our decision-making system in the face of the uncertainty about environmental effects and the disinformation campaigns that our decision makers face is that when they're faced with a hard choice to conserve fish, to cut back on fisheries, to do something that will protect our resource, or to wait and see, the decisive action is one they know is going to cause major grief. They know it's going to bring outcries from industry and so on. And yet we as scientists can't assure them that it's going to really do any good. If they wait and see, they'll get support from our fishing interest groups, short-sighted that we are when we fish. And there's always the possibility that nature will take care of the problem, that it was caused by an environmental factor, not by man. If you look at this decision choice that our decision makers face, I think you see it's actually fully rational for ministers of fisheries and fisheries bureaucrats not to act in the face of advice and warnings. It's much easier, much simpler, and much safer to wait. That's especially true when waiting to see may very well pass the burden of the decision on to your successor. So you don't have to bear any brunt of it at all. Probably the best example we have locally of what happens when this kind of indecision problem is repeated year in and year out has been with British Columbia's most valuable fishery. The most valuable fish in British Columbia is not our commercial fishery, it's the recreational fishery for Chinook salmon right out in front of us here in the Georgia Strait. The total economic value of that recreational fishery, bringing in tourist dollars from the Yanks and that, exceeds the total value of all of our commercial salmon fishery, hands down. Well, that Chinook stock is collapsing, and we're pretty sure that the basic reason for this collapse is that it's overfished. We're pretty sure, in fact, that it's been overfished since probably the mid-1970s. And I don't think there's disagreement among scientists about this at all, but as the collapse has proceeded down to something in the order of 10% of the fish that we had just a couple of decades ago in the Georgia Strait, our government, instead of taking any serious action, has put on a series of what we call band-aids. Silly little pseudo-conservation measures, closing a spring troll fishery, for example, that actually increased the harvest by making it more attractive for sportsmen to go out. Sport spot closures that protect salmon for a few weeks at a time so they get caught a little later in the year than they did before. A 26-inch size limit that protects Chinook salmon for an extra 3 weeks or 4 weeks each spring before they reach the size when they can be harvested. Nonsense like this. Now, we can't say exactly what's going on in situations like this. We can pin down fairly precisely for the period where we have accurate statistics from 75 to about 1990, what the stock was of Chinook salmon was actually doing. We have pretty accurate estimates of the percentage of fish being caught and what that catch represents in terms of abundance. But we don't know what went on earlier. We don't know how severely the stock was collapsing before we started to gather good information. And when we don't have that longer history, we cannot, in consequence, say very much about what the future will bring, particularly if harvests are reduced. Almost all of our scenarios and calculations indicate that that stock is going to remain very low or continue to collapse into the future unless something as major is done. But we can't prove that. And as long as we can't prove it, there'll be the excuse for inaction that bureaucrats love. Bad science. Our scientists, people like me, who do the assessments, the estimates of abundance of salmon or cod off Newfoundland, are not in any way in Canada accountable for mistakes that we might make. There's no onus on us to do a good job. We make lousy statisticians, those of us who thought we were going to be working on fish when actually we work on population statistics, every bit as complex an area of statistical study as anything in the field of statistics. And we've been woefully inadequate about investing in information gathering in our fisheries. So how have we paid the price for these things? Let's take a little bit of a look at the anatomy of the collapse of the cod stocks off Newfoundland. You can't see it very well here. I'll show you again in another slide. There's a little very light green line that collapses down here like this from the 1930s down to a low in the late 1970s, then a bit of a stable period, then a complete collapse in 1992. That's what we back calculate the cod stock off Newfoundland actually looked like over time. We know pretty well how big it was because practically all the fish that were there each year were caught that year or in a few years after the record that you see. But what happened off Newfoundland was that the cod stock had been and harvest had been fairly stable. An inshore fishery that persisted for about three centuries at near the same catch levels. Foreign trawlers arrived off our coast in the late 1950s. They were able to fish out at the edge of the continental shelf where Newfoundlanders had not been able to go very well. Fishing on spawning aggregations of cod. Their harvests reached enormous peaks and started to collapse. In the late 1970s here, in 1977, we took over extended jurisdiction on the East Coast, 200-mile limits. We booted out the foreigners. And there was a window of opportunity for just a few years between 1977 and about 1980 when we could have recovered from the nightmare caused by the foreign fishing. It was generally felt amongst people in Newfoundland that the stock had been grossly depleted. A lot of scientists felt that it had been grossly depleted. The general view in government at the time was that there would probably have to be a very long and painfully slow period of rebuilding the cod stock. But did we get those things? No. In 1980 to 82, instead we got, courtesy of the Canadian taxpayer, a thing called enterprise allocation, in which you and I helped a couple of major Canadian companies, Nat Fish, that you buy your cod in Safeway from, to build a whole new offshore trawl fleet to replace the foreign fleet. So we went back out to sea and basically repeated exactly what the foreigners had done to us. We took high catches for about 6 years through the 1980s, then it started to fall. And in 1992 here, the last year of the fishery, our fleet removed 70% of the total stock of cod left in the ocean in 2 months. Over the course of 1992, they removed over 90% of the remaining stock. Today off Newfoundland, the cod stock is at 0.1% of its abundance in 1950. It's not going to come back, as you'll see in a minute. Not in our lifetimes. Well, how could this happen? How could this incredible window of opportunity that occurred between 1978 and 1980, how could we have screwed up so badly? Well, one argument you might see from Canadian officials is that nobody was paying attention to the scientists. That's absolute nonsense. What you see here is a picture of the recommended harvests by Canadian scientists, these triangles, compared to the bars here, which are the actual catches taken in the fishery. So what actually happened was that the fishery took fewer fish than the scientists recommended. It's not that the scientists were ignored at all. In fact, the fishermen of Newfoundland took the Canadian government to court in the late 1980s to try to force closure of the fishery, and the Canadian government won the case and kept the fishery open for a couple of extra years. So something went very badly wrong, not in the governance of this system, the allowable harvests were followed pretty exactly, but rather in the assessments of the state of the resource and its capability for withstanding harvest. At the time when the stock was collapsing, we were treated to this sort of thing. You can't read this, and it's a good thing. This is a picture of a great big thick report produced by Canadian stock assessment scientists, my colleagues from Newfoundland, in 1991, with vast tables of numbers and statistics and reviews and analyses that all pointed, in their words, towards a recovering cod stock that would soon be healthy. It was very difficult to dig through this barrage of information. Well, what did the information produce? This is another picture showing what the stock actually did. The red line here shows our best back calculation of how many cod were actually in the sea. Again, that's accurate because we caught almost all of them, so we know there were that many there eventually. And those peculiar little lines you see pointing away from the actual population are the Canadian government scientists' estimates of the stock size and projections of it in different years. So the green line here starts out with the scientific estimate of the cod stock just after we took over extended jurisdiction, 3 times higher than it should have been. And the follow that green line was the Canadian scientific projection of how the cod stock was going to recover under our enterprise allocation fishing plan. And in each year after that, you see the estimate published by our scientists and their projection of what was going to happen. You see a gap here about 1985 to 1990. The gap there was simply because they stopped publishing estimates, and the reason they did was that by about 1985, a couple of scientists were responsible enough to look back and to see that they had in fact been grossly overestimating the stock, and when the scientists made that fact public, they were transferred to another region, and the government stopped producing its assessment reports for a few years. But they went back online, continuing to make exactly the same mistakes as recently as 1 year before the fishery closed. So they not only grossly overestimated the abundance of fish, they didn't seem capable of even learning that they were making the mistake and of doing better in the long term. Now we've been able to go back and figure out exactly how and why this mistake was made. It turns out that our scientists were trying to use the success rates of commercial fishermen to provide an index of abundance of the cod. Well, the commercial success rates of our fishermen did not drop very fast as the stock collapsed, because commercial fishermen are very good at finding the last fish. And when the scientists made this rather silly assumption that the commercial fishermen were searching the world at random, they of course overestimated how much was left. Another thing they did that I find even more bizarre is that not until the late 1980s did they ever even look at the relationship between the reproductive success we call recruitment of the cod and the abundance of spawning cod. It was a matter of deeply held dogma, it still is on the east coast of Canada, that cod produce millions of eggs, and so their reproductive success or recruitment doesn't depend on how many adults there are. There's always, in their arguments, a surplus of adults. Well, staring those scientists in the face over much of the cod collapse were the data you see here, showing a very dramatic and profound relationship between how many adults there are and how many babies they produce, something that any school child should be able to tell you we should expect. So not only do they overestimate the abundance of fish, they violently overestimated the reproductive capacity of the cod in the face of harvesting and depletion. So to summarize, what happened on the East Coast is that our biologists blew it big time by using a bad abundance index, and they failed to recognize probably the most serious concern that any biologist involved in the management of fisheries should have, this thing called recruitment overfishing, not allowing enough fish to spawn. Now, these are not subtle errors. They're the kind of things that warnings been published in fisheries textbooks about since the 1930s. Yet our management system was unable to take those basic lessons. If you want to look at the future, this is a pathetic best guess we're making today of how the cod stock will rebuild if it's not fished at all. We know it needs to be up here at about a million tons of fish, way up above where the pointer is here, and it very likely will not reach that level before near the middle of the next century, if at all. None of the projections indicate that any Newfoundlander alive today will be able to live in an outport and fish again, not for cod. So we blew that one big time. Unfortunately, we're seeing a move today in fisheries management all around the world to try to essentially adopt the same kind of management system that led to the cod disaster. That management system is what's called an output control or a quota management control that relies on scientists estimating the abundance of fish and then using their estimates of abundance to decide what a safe, allowable harvest is each year. Well, we've got to change that. It simply is not going to work. We have no indication that the things that went wrong with the cod fishery can be corrected by any kind of economical measures to gather more information or anything like that. It's a problem we're going to have to live with, and we're not going to be able to implement some of the fancy ideas that people have had about simplifying our fisheries management by having simple quotas. Well, let me return now to this striking difference for a minute between BC and Newfoundland and try to answer the question why it is that we have salmon left in British Columbia. We have a technology out there that's every bit as destructive as in Newfoundland. We're perfectly capable of wiping out the resource we have that all of us prize. I think the fundamental reason here is an extraordinarily simple one. And it's that we manage our Pacific salmon not by knowing or pretending to know or being so arrogant as to think we know how many fish there are in the sea. We manage them instead by what's called exploitation rate management. That is, when a run of salmon approaches a fishing area, like this set of counts of fish of sockeye salmon entering the Fraser River at Mission, what we do instead of having the whole ocean open to fishing is we have very short, concentrated fishery openings. So if you've been around Stevenson or the mouth of the Fraser, you'll notice that every summer on Monday morning or Sunday evening sometimes, there's a 12-hour or 24-hour fishery opening. What those fishery openings do is to cut massive holes in the stock of fish. Those red lines indicate the depth of holes we think were cut by three openings that occurred in 1992 on a sockeye run. Now, a key thing about the way we manage salmon is that without ever knowing how many fish are involved in the total run, without ever knowing the area under that green curve that measures total abundance passing Mission, we can be pretty confident about what percentage of the run will be removed when we set these holes, when we cut these holes by having small fishery openings. And traditionally, we've had very stable exploitation rates over the years in our salmon populations because of this hole-cutting method of management, or exploitation rate method. Now, what that means to the salmon is that if the salmon come back in low numbers in some year, the catch is automatically reduced, because when you take the same percentage of a smaller stock, you take fewer. So we cut back automatically on our harvesting when there's fewer around, and when there's more around, we take more. That basic feedback confers a resilience on our salmon's populations and our management system that's simply not there in a situation like Newfoundland. Once in a while, we screw up. And when we screw up with our salmon management, it generally is in situations where we have what's called a gauntlet, where we harvest a run of salmon at a whole series of locations along the coast. Last year, most of you have probably heard, we very nearly lost the Adams River sockeye run. We came within one 12-hour fishery opening of destroying the most magnificent fishery resource in British Columbia. Now, the way that basically happened was that as the Adams River Run approached the coast here in BC, it hit the coast way north, up around Noyes Island in Alaska and off the Charlottes. And up in that, in the fishing areas up there, a substantial number of sockeye were harvested before we had any idea how many were there. We had a preseason forecast of around 7 million fish, but we didn't really know. And the fishermen, as the fish concentrated against the coast, handily caught a couple of million of them. Then as the fish migrated down the coast, they came in through the Johnson Straits, where another 3-odd million of them were harvested by a very intense purse seine and gillnet fishery. Now, all this is perfectly normal. We've been doing this kind of harvesting every year for a long time. We've gotten away with it. We cut holes in them in the Johnson Strait, just like I showed you on the Fraser. But we've had in recent years a progressively more complicated allocation, a progressively stronger demand on our scientists to provide more accurate assessments of abundance, and to use those to provide more and more little small fisheries and allocations of fish to natives and to gillnetters and to everybody. So a poor biologist working for the Pacific Salmon Commission was forced, against his better judgment, to take the numbers that he had from the harvest in the Johnson Strait and to make an estimate of the absolute number of fish that were pooling from the Adams River Run at the mouth of the Fraser River. Ordinarily, we don't try to harvest very much at the mouth of the Fraser from the Adams Run because they sit at the river mouth in a very concentrated mass and are very vulnerable to over-harvesting. But this last year, our system decided instead of the traditional way of doing things, they would use this estimate that the biologist had produced and go ahead and have an opening or two at the mouth of the river. They had the first of those, and it became really obvious that they were virtually destroyed the run by that point, and they stopped it before the second opening. But the key thing is that we had violated this basic principle of managing by exploitation rates, and we'd gotten arrogant about our ability to estimate the number of fish. All this appeared in the newspaper to you in a very peculiar way, this overestimate that the biologists made of about 2 million more fish than were actually there leaving the Johnson Strait, was widely called in the newspapers the missing 2 million fish. It wasn't missing at all. It was a stock assessment error, a scientific error of a kind that we inevitably will make when we're dealing with highly variable populations in a highly variable environment with lousy data. It's the style of management that really went wrong, not the assessment system. We can't run a gauntlet like that safely. We can't satisfy the interests of North Coast native fishermen and South Coast native fishermen and trollers and seiners and gillnetters and all the other interest groups that clamor for attention today with salmon. We've got to pull our fisheries back and make them safer, or we won't have them before very long. Well, this fixed exploitation rate concept is something that just about everybody can understand. If you don't want to catch more than 10% or 50% of the fish, don't expose more than that percentage to the risk of harvest. So if we can take a lesson from the salmon, we've got a very simple principle upon which we can start to build safer and sustainable systems for managing fisheries throughout the world, based on this simple idea of just don't expose so many of them to the risks of our technology. So I see great hope in the lessons we can learn from our Pacific salmon. The hope actually goes a little bit beyond that, and I don't think I'll bother talking about examples. When we get to digging, actually, into fisheries that have persisted for a long time around the world. You know, you all get Charlie tuna out of a can, you take it for granted. Well, the main reason we still have tuna fisheries around the world is that most of the world's tuna are out in the middle of the ocean where it's still uneconomical to pursue them. Most of the harvest is taken close to coast. It's as though there were a closure over much of the ocean to the harvesting of our tunas. Our salmon fisheries, of course, are managed this way. There are a number of fisheries other places around the world that have been sustained for long periods of time, and every time we look at them, we find this business of a natural or man-made refuge from much of the risk of harvesting by man. Something else we discovered recently, just to mention to you as an aside here, I'm not sure how understandable this will be, but we've been looking from a kind of theoretical point of view at these simple fixed harvest rate strategies, and we've just discovered in the last 2 years that they're probably the best possible way for us to deal with the huge environmental changes that are going on in the ocean as well. This is some results from a computer model where we put into the computer the kind of violent, enormous changes in ocean carrying capacity that have been documented in recent years in the North Pacific. Then what we did is we told the computer to calculate for us what the best number of fish to allow to spawn would be each year, knowing the entire future every year. So we pretend we know that that simulated environment will actually occur. And the result from the computer is this dotted line, and basically what the computer tells us is that if we really knew what the future was going to bring, we would follow what's called an anticipatory policy. We would start to cut back on our harvest just before these periods of high ocean capacity in order to have lots of young fish going out in the ocean at just the right time to capitalize on that production opportunity. In other words, we would use our ability to make predictions about the long term to improve the performance of the production system out there in the ocean. That's the dotted line. Now, this little green line you see here tracks the dotted line very closely. And in fact, it gives a simulated harvest performance about 95% of what we could get if we actually knew what the future was going to bring. Well, that simulated line is the line you get when you harvest 45% of the fish every year. Dead simple. Any fool working for government ought to be able to implement a policy like that. And what happens is that this natural tracking or feedback capability of a simple harvest rate policy lets the stock build up and go down as the environment becomes better and poorer for production. It isn't quite optimum. It doesn't quite build up the population as rapidly as it should. But in a world where we're not likely to ever know what the future is going to bring in terms of climate, it certainly is a good second best to perfect knowledge. So there's a lot of hope, I think, in fisheries today in terms of a kind of theoretical point of view that if we can sell and implement these simple fixed harvest rate strategies, we're going to gain greatly from it in terms of sustainability. Well, I've now pretty much finished the Carl the Fisheries Scientist Biologist part of my talk, and I want to speculate and talk to you a little bit about that factory here in British Columbia, that factory that has far too many fishermen chasing the available stock of fish, that is hideously inefficient from an economic point of view, hideously wasteful. And I personally think the key to our future is not so much the way we manage our harvest biologically, it's what we do with that monster out there that's out there today economically. Around the world today, the developed countries of the world put more money into our fisheries than come out. The fisheries management agencies and management costs combined with the costs of harvesting exceed the value of our fisheries throughout the developed world. That's not good. The public bears the cost of this management, not the industry. We're essentially subsidizing industries around the world. And it's not fair to us, and it's certainly not sustainable in the long term as we begin to find other pressing needs for our public financial resources. Our salmon fishery is a catastrophic loser. It brings in a gross of about $250 million a year to commercial fishing. The operating costs each year to the industry, the costs for keeping their boats and operating them and hiring crew and burning gas and chasing each other around the ocean, use up more than half of that income immediately. It costs us somewhere between $70 and $100 million, depending on how you partition the $180 million Department of Fisheries and Oceans budget in this region, to manage the fishery, to run around and enforce and protect and enhance and all the other public management functions we take. And then we pay the fishermen, we the people of Canada, pay the fishermen an additional net $60 million in seasonal unemployment insurance. So when you add the pluses and the minuses, our current commercial fishery is operating about $40 million in the hole. Anything that a commercial fisherman tells you is his net earnings is coming not from the resource, it's coming from your pocket and my pocket. ultimately. The key reason for this is that we've got something in the order of 3 to 4 times the number of commercial fishing vessels out there that we should. And perhaps the best signal of this is what scientists see when they examine the harvest rate, the percentage of fish that are removed from the water each year in different areas along the coast, in relation to the number of boats that are out there fishing. What this scatter of dots says is that over a very wide range of number of boats showing up in our fishing areas, we harvest the same percentage and same number of fish. We have at least 5 times the capacity out there needed to harvest what's available. What this means out in a fishing area in a place like the Johnson Strait or at the mouth of the Fraser River is that most of the time when a fisherman is out there burning up fuel, burning up time, he's not really fishing at all. He's sweeping water that's already been swept by the guy who was there a few minutes before him. When a gillnet opening occurs now at the mouth of the Fraser River, up in the Fraser River, we estimate that something like 80% of the sockeye salmon in the river are removed in the first couple of hours of the opening. So most of the time that you see the boats sitting out there, they're literally sitting idle. The cost is there to all of us, but the production is not, the value is not. So what I would say has got to be a key step to the future for us as Canadians to begin to recapture the values of this resource and to distribute the way it's managed in different ways, is to drastically cut back the size of that commercial fishing fleet, to begin to implement massive cost recovery taxation systems. We calculate that we could end up with something like a net value, positive value, of about $90 million. That could then be put into the very real costs and enormous costs of producing and protecting the fish. Right now, we have thousands and thousands of people catching fish and a few hundred overworked people producing them. That's crazy. We should have a few hundred people catching the fish and thousands producing and protecting them. And that we can do fairly easily if we can break the deadlock that our current licensing system has on access to harvesting out there. We've been doing some simple spreadsheet calculations of just how that might go, of just how a simple tactic like putting a royalty, a landing tax on the harvest, just as we do with the forest industry, and then using that landing tax to buy back or get rid of fishing licenses, how it might go over time. And the calculations indicate that we could reduce the size of the fishing fleet by about 60% over the next 10 years with a landing tax that's smaller than than the royalties we now use in our forest industry. A landing tax is somewhere in the order of 20% to do the job quite nicely. And we'd be left with a leaner, smaller, safer fishing industry that would really be earning a living. A man who was left in that industry genuinely be able to say he was employed in it rather than seasonally and partially employed in it and the rest of the time the burden on the rest of us. Over time, the transient in earnings and costs would not all be positive. There would be a substantial red period, if you like, during which we, the public, would have to continue to provide and perhaps provide more income assistance to our industry to cover the costs of transition, the costs of retraining, and all the other things that are going to happen when an industry loses a large part of its employment. But it strikes me that if we're talking about a future for Canada, that the long-term gains from that in terms of financial resources and human resources made available to produce and protect the fish is well worth that red line part for the next decade or so. So to sum up, the vision I guess I'm trying to show you is one in which we try to change our fisheries here in Canada in two very fundamental ways. The first one is to force our industries to pay for themselves, to force the recognition that we, the public, the owners of the resource out there, should not be bearing the costs of protecting and maintaining our own resource in the face of the damages that potentially are brought on it by industry or others. And then I think we need to develop very clear standards of safety in husbandry, very clear standards of tolerable exploitation rates, what we're willing to live with in terms of our government bureaucracies, their inefficiencies, their errors, and their scientific mistakes. I think we can begin to move this way in fairly simple ways. I think the whole matter of industrial reorganization, the buyback programs, and the other alternatives for reducing the sizes of our fishing fleet here in BC are already underway. There's a roundtable process, it's called, in which the fishing industry of BC is looking very hard at ways to help to pay for itself and to reduce its size to a manageable level. I think we need to begin to recognize that that we've been making gross scientific blunders. A good part of the reason for those blunders has been hopelessly inadequate investment in information gathering. And a key reason for not making that investment in information gathering is the public can't afford it anymore. But with a sensible and sane and smaller and leaner fishing system, we can begin to make those investments in information that are so badly needed. And then finally, I think we need a lot of just plain simple down-to-earth standards for safety and design in our regulatory systems, just making sure that the holes we cut are acceptably small. Now, I don't think this is a complex plan, a complex program. I think it's entirely doable. So I'll close by saying that I'm optimistic about the future of our fisheries here in BC. Thank you. I can't believe my voice held up that long.
What accounts for the variation in ocean carrying capacity and what impact might be on that capacity from global climate change?
The question is, what causes these big fluctuations in ocean carrying capacity and what is climate change doing to that? The carrying capacity changes, we believe, are due to very large-scale changes in ocean circulation. With those changes in circulation and the pattern of winds over the North Pacific and so on, we get huge changes in the amount of upwelling of nutrients from the ocean bottom. We get big areas of the ocean where the temperatures become unsuitable for some kinds of fish like salmon and so on. It had been thought until very recently that much of that was a progressive warming of the North Pacific in conjunction with global climate change. But we know, in looking at various kinds of long-term climate records, tree ring analyses and things like that, are starting to see what appears to be a very complex natural rhythm of up and down. And in fact, that natural rhythm predicts some of the changes we've seen in the last couple of years towards cooling again. So the bottom line is, we haven't got a clue, but we don't think it's all man-made. Yes. Yeah. The question is the Alaska fishery a wild card for management of BC stocks? It certainly is. Alaska sits, most salmon when they enter the ocean move northward to grow and live. That means that fish from British Columbia move into Alaska where they're vulnerable to Alaskan fisheries, but the Alaskan fish don't come south. This means that in a game theoretic sense, we don't have, it's an asymmetric game. We don't have a threat to hold over them. So far, they've been pretty good until this last year. The bizarre events that occurred last summer with Chinook salmon, where the Alaskan troll fishermen insisted on continuing to harvest Chinooks in spite of uniform recommendations not to by American and Canadian scientists, it appears now were concentrated, were not really representing the state of Alaska at all. They were representing one administrative district in the state of Alaska, the district around Juneau, where the state capital is. It was two hopelessly incompetent state of Alaska biologists working in conjunction with the fishing, with one small part of the Alaskan fishing industry, one small group of trawlers. It led to the noise you saw in the newspapers. I just got back from a meeting in Alaska where considerable outrage by the rest of the Alaskan fishing community and scientific community was being expressed about that whole Chinook business. And I think there's some reason to hope that that those characters are going to be asked to clean up their act. But in principle, there's not a whole lot we can do. Should they decide to act like jackasses, we'll eat it, we'll wear it, and we'll have to find ways to live with it. Way in the back up there. The question is the extent to which BC's forest industry represents a threat to our fishery. It's an enormous threat. It's the single largest habitat threat to salmon in BC. This is kind of curious because if you look at the public outcries about loss of salmon habitat, what you hear about is urban streams and Kamano and the Iona sewage treatment plant and a bunch of other things that really have very little to do with our salmon production system. It is an enormous threat. We're seeing massive, cumulative, long-term damage to the water systems of BC unfolding, particularly in the central and north coast areas, where logging practices have been less than up to standard, and where high rainfall means that you get huge flushing and flooding and events like that. The only major salmon production system for which we're now fairly sure that the impacts are being felt in a horrible way is in the Rivers Inlet area around Okino Lake. Rivers Inlet used to support the third largest sockeye salmon fishery in BC, catches of about 1 million sockeye a year. And it's now down to runs of the order of 100,000 fish. And the streams around Okino Lake, 10 or 12 streams where the fish used to spawn, are virtually unusable by salmon. The stream banks have gone unstable. The streams are ripping back and forth over the alluvial valley bottoms. They're completely unstable. And we're feeling it. That's a century-long problem. What I fear about it is that instead of facing up to it, doing what we can to protect and restore and manage the habitat, that what we'll instead use it for is one of those excuses for inaction. That what we'll see is people saying, well, the habitat's messed up, so don't stop us from harvesting. We see plenty of that kind of nonsense already today, particularly from the sport fishing interests. Don't blame us, it's habitat. It's one of them eight-armed things. Yes. The official American word about what happened in Washington and Oregon is that the salmon fisheries that are closed down completely now south of the border were the final last cumulative effect of habitat destruction in Washington and Oregon due to logging, due to the dam developments on the Columbia River, and a whole variety of other water mismanagement activities. I think that the fact of the matter is that it was a combination of habitat destruction in places like the Columbia, and some pretty gross fisheries mismanagement as well, over-harvesting problems. That collapse of the stocks that showed up first in the Columbia River and has gradually worked its way northward is spreading into southwestern British Columbia as well with our Chinook and Coho. We're really beginning to wonder whether there might not be something else entirely going on that we don't understand. Some factor beyond the common scapegoats that's causing a spreading wave of decline. Yes, sir. Question is, how much of the changes we see, like in the Northern Cardstock, can be blamed on cold water or Bridget Bardot or whatever? Well, one of the things you ought to get used to is that our Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans staff is not there to serve you. They're there to keep their jobs. So when the cod fishery collapsed, there was an incredible variety of things popped out of the Canadian government about the causes of that collapse. There was the cold water hypothesis that the Atlantic was too cold and the cod were losing their antifreeze and freezing to death. And then The latest thing, I guess, Sheila Copps had a new official line on the TV the other day about how it was warm water that was doing it and so on. There's a group of scientists on the East Coast that have been doing a pretty careful analysis of very long-term climate records from off Newfoundland. And what they find is that that cod fishery that was sustained for four centuries did so in the face of some considerably more violent climate changes than anything that's happened in the last few years. Cod have a cycle in productivity. They have about a 10-year up-and-down rhythm in their productivity that's associated, we're pretty sure it's associated with changes in salinity and temperature. But the overwhelming effect of overfishing just overrode that cycle entirely during the 70s and 80s. Yes, sir.
How would you rate the effectiveness of the West Coast Damage Enhancement Program over the 70s and 80s?
How would I rate the effectiveness of the West Coast Salmonid Enhancement Program over the 70s and 80s? Well, I'll just answer you very simply. We were ripped off big time. We, the public of Canada, were ripped off big time. And if the fishing industry had had to pay even one penny of the cost recovery they said they would, that program would have been stopped a long time ago. That coho picture I showed you was the surface of the iceberg. The Chinook and coho production system, which was the biggest part of the enhancement expenditures, is an utter disaster. We cannot show any marginal value at all to Canada from that production system. We were pretty good about growing chum and pink salmon, which weren't a big part of the original program, and they're really great for what's called stamp fishing. The chums come in late, not worth anything, but to give fishermen time so they can qualify for UI. And it turned out we were really great about growing the chums and pinks that are worth as much as 20 cents a pound for cat food these days. But it's pretty hard to count those as successes, I suppose. They come up in the numbers. We also have this little shell game where you take a lake like Chilco Lake that's been producing sockeye for 5,000 odd years, upwards of 1 million fish each year, and you fly over it with an airplane, drop some fertilizer on it, lake fertilization program and salmon enhancement, and all of a sudden that 1 million sockeye starts appearing as part of the benefits of the program. Yeah. We've been ripped off big time. Yes, sir. The question is, what's my opinion on the roe herring fishery, I assume you're talking about? In the 1950s and 1960s, there was an enormous industrial reduction fishery for herring on this coast. The herring were ground up and used for fertilizer. And that fishery peaked about 1967 to 69 in that area, and during that time it virtually destroyed the herring stock. They came back fairly rapidly, and a roe fishery for them developed to sell roe to Japan. Now, that roe fishery is incredibly stupid and wasteful. If we're going to harvest herring roe, we should be doing it on kelp. We should let them come in to spawn on racks and take a safe percentage of the eggs and sell them to Japanese and let the rest hatch and things like that, rather than chasing them out of purse seiners. But we don't have any evidence that the roe fishery has done any serious damage to the salmon. In fact, this time when the herring stocks went through a catastrophic low in the late 60s, where they were much lower than anything had been since then, there was actually a peak in Chinook salmon production in the Georgia Strait. There was changes in coho salmon. They started moving out of the Georgia Strait more at that time, seemed to be moving further afield to forage when there are no herring available. But we've never been able to establish, by looking at the long-term records and changes, any kind of a really major impact of even the herring reduction fishery, let alone the roe fishery. One of the things that, in the last few years, if you're a sport fisherman, you may notice you don't see a lot of herring around. The herring are out there. They're in deeper water now because of the very high surface temperatures. The Georgia Strait's the warmest it's ever been in the last few years. Kids swimming at Campbell River, an unheard of thing until a few years ago. And when you go out with echo sounders, and when they go out to do acoustic surveys, they find the herrings. They're finding them very deep, not in the surface schools we used to see when we were sport fishing for coho and that. And all of their spawning ground assessments indicate good abundances of spawners up until this year there's been a drought. We're actually seeing some of the old stocks coming back that were lost entirely during the reduction fishery as well here in the Georgia Strait. The mouth of Howe Sound, they're starting to spawn there again. So I'd say that's not one you really ought to worry too much about. There's bigger problems to be worried about. Back in the back. The question is, what's the effects of farm fish production on wild fish? We don't know. There's a bit of a worry about this because over exactly the same period that the fish farming system has developed around the Georgia Strait, we've seen a progressive decline in the marine survival rates of coho and Chinook salmon produced in our hatcheries. We've generally attributed those declines to other factors like the ocean getting warmer, or to overstocking the Georgia Strait with fish. But there's a nagging suspicion that it's just possible that some of that decline has been due perhaps to disease transmission from the farms. It's a pretty controversial subject. I think the general view there is that they've decided to write off the wild production system. Yeah, there's a... You know, in agriculture in general, there's a fundamental, and aquaculture, there's a fundamental conflict between wild and man-made populations. Wild populations are disease reservoirs. Natural creatures are a bloody, swimming, infested mass of parasites and all sorts of things, perfectly natural for them to be so. The last thing a farmer wants in his backyard is that kind of source of problems. So potentially the conflicts are really severe. Pat?
Would you comment on the native fishery? You haven't mentioned the native fishery here, and I'm just wondering to what extent it's either complicated the situation, or has it had an impact, or would you just comment on
Would I comment on the native fishery? Well, in terms of numbers of fish involved in the native fishery, the allocations so far have been pretty minuscule. A lot of the noise you hear about the native fishery to date from commercial fishermen is looking for a scapegoat. But there's a fundamental problem that the native fisheries are highest in priority in government. It's a constitutional right that they be given the highest priority of access to the fish. But they are the last ones physically to have that access. This means that the entire rest of the fishery has to be managed in such a way as to provide a priority number of fish left at the end of the gauntlet for those native fisheries. And all of us that have looked into how to do that safely have failed to find any very safe way to manage those native fisheries, particularly if they grow much larger than they are today. And we certainly see no way to safely manage a monstrous gauntlet of native fisheries stretched up the Fraser River and prosecuted by gill netting rather than traditional fishing methods. That, if that goes ahead and proceeds as it has so far incrementally in the last few years, it'll be devastating. But I keep looking at that and I keep saying, no, they can't be that stupid. The government can't let this keep happening. Yeah, there we go. Here, I just told you how stupid they are, right? Yes, ma'am.
Is there any particular profile of
harp
technology that
there's two different views about technology, and I've not been able to make up my mind about these. One view says we should use the most efficient technology that we can, purse seining and things like that. Make it more selective. Some of our most efficient technologies are also capable of being very selective about which fish they take and which they let go so we can manage biodiversity better. And by harvesting in the cheapest way, make the most money available, earnings from the salmon, to cover the real costs of producing them. So let's just use efficient technology and employ people instead in the protection and production of fish. That's one argument. The other argument is, let's try to develop community-based management systems involving much simpler technologies that we know aren't dangerously destructive, fish wheels, things like that, that can be selective, that can employ a lot more people, and particularly out in the small coastal communities that are suffering badly today. As the great wave of urban-oriented commercial fishermen moves up and down the coast, people living in little communities like around Rivers Inlet and even up at the Skeena have very little chance to make a living anymore. And that would be, in many people's minds, a crime to lose that cultural diversity just to make fishing cheaper. I don't know. I see really strong arguments in both directions. I do think we will see a substantial shift towards community-based management, in which much more of the responsibility for managing that enormously complex system out there will be shifted down to the level of local communities. Management, that means protecting habitat, enforcing regulations, enhancing wisely, everything will be made much more local. How the fishing part of that works and should work and will work, I don't know. Because I don't think the fishing part of it ought to be the big part in the first place. I think that's a fundamental mistake we've made, is to concentrate on our fishing fleet rather than on the whole production system. Yes, ma'am. There are a whole bunch of places in BC where community-based management would make a great deal of sense right now. Most of our north coast fisheries, from the Skeena River and down through the central coast and out onto the west coast of Vancouver Island, are highly localized already. And there's no reason that they couldn't be managed entirely on a local community initiative type basis. The only fisheries we have that are bad news from a community point of view are the big gauntlet fisheries for sockeye and pink salmon of the Fraser River that move down across the whole coast to a whole mass of fisheries. We could pull those back. We could pull back into community-based management systems within the Fraser River, except in a considerable loss in the commercial value of the fish by harvesting them in the river rather than out when they're bright in the ocean. There are a lot of things we could do to make those bigger fisheries safer and smaller, and reallocated more towards community terminal fisheries. That's another one where I don't know the answer to just where the best balance is. I think probably the best strategy right now is to start pulling back on the worst of our interception and outside fisheries. Gradually start reducing the number of people involved in them and the catches that are allocated to them, and start building up the safer fisheries inside areas and community-based operations. Just see how far we can take that. Alaska is doing this now in a major way, and they love it. They just absolutely love it. They wonder how in the world they were ever so stupid as to allow some of their interception fisheries to develop in the first place. The fishermen love it, the communities love it. Everyone is better off, but it's a hard thing to get started. Yes, ma'am.
Is there any chance that the huge diversity in Ottawa is going to be slimmed down somewhat?
The question is any chance the huge bureaucracy in Ottawa will be slimmed down? Yeah, I think it already is. I think there's a set of budget cuts planned for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans that have to impact on Ottawa to at least some degree. It's really scary when you look at the Department of Fisheries and Oceans budget, what proportion of its manpower and budget and activity is in central administration. Here in the Pacific region, $35 million out of $180 million, just in this region alone, is going to central office administration. That has really nothing to do with protecting fish. It's certainly been my experience that when your basic Ottawa bureaucrat comes out here to the West Coast and starts providing advice and pontification and so on like that not only are they ill-informed, they're misinformed, and they're bloody dangerous. They really are bloody dangerous to us. And it seems like that sort of one of the first qualifications for getting promoted to one of them Ottawa offices is to do a poor job in the region you came from. Eek.
It's almost always difficult to cut off questions. I think it's unusually difficult tonight. It's been such a lively question period. But some of you I know have to be going on, and others of you may want to come up afterwards and ask your question. I'd now like to call on Dr. David Randall, the Associate Dean of Graduate Studies, to thank our speaker.
I was in Athens, Georgia, talking with some scientists from the Environmental Protection Agency, and one of them said, "We had a guy from your place come and tell us about the Environmental Protection Agency." I said, "Who was that?" And they said, "Well," and the name had slipped their mind for the moment. I said, "Well, tell me something about him." He said, "Well, he didn't spare the criticism. He told us about ourselves in a very straightforward manner. He was very well informed. He had a lot of views about things, views that he held solidly and defended in a very clear manner." I said, "Oh, yeah, I know who that is." I was walking through a vineyard with an Italian, Cesare Ponti. He'd operated a vineyard for 2,000 years. The vineyard was no longer profitable. I asked him a little bit about the vineyard. He said, "Well, Pliny talked about the wine that was made here by my ancestors." And I said, "Well, Cesare, what was the wine like?" He said, "Pliny said it wasn't very good." But he said, "We've made a lot of changes over the years." He said, "For about the first 1,000 years, we would have the vines growing this way and this way. And then because we started to use trucks, we just had them this way. And then we talked a little bit more about the wines of the area, and I said to him, why don't you dig the vines up, you know, and grow onions or something? You can make a profit." And he looked at me and he said, You want me to dig this vineyard up that's been here for 2,000 years? How could you possibly ask me to do that?" Now, I feel the same way about the salmon population in British Columbia. I don't want to be part of the population that sees the collapse of this fishery. I feel somewhat optimistic that it may not happen in my lifetime, but the reason I feel that is because of the presence of Carl Waters. Thanks very much, Carl, for a very informative and a very enjoyable lecture. Thank you.